Welcome back to Creative Therapy Umbrella. This is a place where we talk about all different types of creative arts therapies, creative approaches to therapy, expressive arts therapy, and everything in between. In today's episode, I get to talk with Amanda Bryant, who is a music therapist, and she shares her idea of using this concept called design thinking and bringing this concept into the therapy world. She talks about how she kind of came up with this idea, and it was listening to another podcast, and that podcast is also listed in the show notes. But what's really cool is that design thinking is a framework for handling problems and building new opportunities through creative thinking, innovation, and lots of experimentation. It's such a really humanistic framework to be grounded in when you're trying to think of intervention ideas, trying to problem solve, and really get your creative ideas going. So Amanda shows us the whole non-linear process and talks about all the different steps. There's 5 different steps: empathizing, defining, ideating, prototyping, and then testing. And she goes through examples, and it's just such a cool idea. I actually saw Amanda present on this topic in our regional conference, and I was totally hooked, not only because it's a very grounding process to think of really abstract ideas in, which I think can be really, really helpful for students, but also it's just such a cool way to look at problems. I would highly suggest going into the show notes and downloading Amanda's PowerPoints for this episode, because she's got some great visuals in there, lots of extra information, and it's really helpful to kind of see everything as she's going through all of this stuff. You'll also notice that there is an additional download in the show notes that is the Quick Guide to Boost Creativity, and that is a freebie that I wanted to put out there just to help therapists come up with new ideas and do some different creative exercises to get your juices flowing. So enjoy both of those downloads and enjoy this episode, and I'll talk with you on the other side. Okay, Amanda, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Kate. I'm excited to talk about design thinking.
I can't wait to hear it. I've actually already heard some of it, but I'm excited to hear more of it. Can you start off by telling the listeners just a little bit about you and what you do in your work?
Sure. So I've been practicing for a long time. I did my undergrad in music therapy at Arizona State University, worked, interned at a large hospital mental health facility in California, returned to Arizona and did a year's worth of work for Suzanne Oliver, who's one of my early mentors. She owns Neurologic Music Therapy Services of Arizona. And then we moved to Colorado. He got accepted to grad school in Colorado. Been in Colorado ever since. Started my private practice, as a young, fairly young, green music therapist. Developed a lot of different music therapy programs across the Denver, Boulder area. So school programs, clinic-based programs, and one of the founding music therapists for Adams Camp. I started the Joshua School program. I started the Kid Street program at Children's Hospital. I served Anchor Center for Blind Children, but I'm not wearing an autism hat. I have a lot of training in vision impairment. So I was at Anchor Center for Blind Children for a really long time, about 18 years. So that's an area that is really, I'm really passionate about, that I've done a lot of work with. So just developed a lot of programs in private practice in Colorado. And now my practice is pretty much 100% clinic-based. I have an office in Lafayette. I live in Boulder County. So I'm up north. I've let a lot of those bigger school contracts and south part of town things pass those on to other therapists. And so I'm just kind of up here in this neck of the woods now. And then I went back to grad school. And so when I was in grad school at CSU, doing my master's in music therapy and studying really emphasizing the neuroscience of music and also the neuroscience of ASD, right? So those kind of, the marriage of those two was sort of the work of my grad school. And I don't know if you or your listeners can relate, but you know, when you're in graduate school, you just get so spun up in the minutiae of what you're studying, you know, you find areas to, or ways to kind of disengage and listen or absorb other pieces of information. And so one of the things I started doing was while I was exercising or working out, I was started listening to podcasts. And so I heard this wonderful podcast through NPR, and I'm going to find the name of it for you so your listeners can reference it.
Yes, we'll put it in the show notes.
It's a neuroscience related podcast, kind of psychology and neuroscience, but I wasn't necessarily seeking out design thinking. I didn't know what it was about. I just was following that particular podcast. So the podcast feed would show up on my phone and I would click on the episodes that looked most interesting to me. And so one morning I clicked on the design thinking and I really just did this deep dive, Kate, into listening and having all these multiple aha moments. I think hopefully you and your listeners can relate to that when you hear someone speaking from a perspective that you feel you share. And I knew intuitively that I, as I won't say old, as a seasoned clinician, I had been using these principles, not all of them to the extent that I think about now being more knowledgeable about design thinking, but I was certainly using them. And I remember pausing the podcast and thinking about things and then playing it again, like rewinding it so I could hear points again. And I had this, you know, I had again that I'll describe it as an aha moment of this is so applicable to clinicians. It wasn't designed for clinicians, that this particular podcast. It was just about design thinking for the general population, like how to apply the principles to your life, particularly if you feel like you're at a transition in your life. But I saw the value for us working with clients, not only as in our clinical work, but also for us as clinicians in how we grow. And I had this sort of powerful thought, which perhaps you have had and others can relate to as well as me. I had this thought of, you know, people should know about this. You know, like I need to dig deeper into this idea of design thinking because I feel that I've been doing aspects of it very intuitively. And I had this realization that it was probably design thinking that had kept me going as a therapist and why I've never felt burnt out. I won't say never, but why I've been able to transition into new chapters of my professional life with positivity, with risk-taking, with, you know, hopefully a more creative mindset, and maybe you or other people can relate to this. Often you feel stuck and you need to know how to get out of being stuck. How do I get unstuck? And design thinking is all about that. It values keep trying, keep going. Design thinking values the perception of the user or the use of something over the perception of the designer, right? So as we as clinicians, it values the perception of our clients and our clients' families more than us. Or if you're just thinking about it applied to your life or your growth as a clinician, then you would say, oh, design thinking is valuing me going through these multiple stages of growth or these multiple stages of learning. more than like what I'm actually learning. That it's necessary to continue this cycle of empathizing with the situation you have, defining the problems that you have, making sure you're focusing on the right problem, and we can talk about that. And then brainstorming, and prototyping. Brainstorming in the design thinking world is called ideating, and experimenting is called prototyping. And so I really just had this moment of clarity while listening and re-listening to the podcast, thinking, I've been doing this. And I think that it's what's helped me move through, like I said, different seasons of my professional life, and that other clinicians should know about it. And if I'm benefiting from it and I'm feeling an intuitive sense about it, then I think other clinicians would as well. So that was sort of the birth of me then doing a deeper dive of research into design thinking and reading more about it. And then I developed these two presentations, which I think, you know, you just did at the Midwestern Region Conference. So I did one of them last year at Regional in wherever we were, Missouri, I think. Where were we? I can't remember.
I can't remember last year either. It feels like decades ago, last year.
Where we weren't just meeting online. anyway, so I created this presentation called Design Thinking for Clinicians 1.0. And then this year I decided to do I got a lot of positive feedback, you know, those few moments of people saying, oh, this really makes sense. And what else, you know, share some more information. And so then I created a Design Thinking 2.0 course, which I also did, that sort of emphasized more what the research has been on design thinking in the healthcare industry, and in particular, how it's related to me and my practice.
Yeah.
So let's see. So design thinking is a framework. It's an approach for thinking about problems. And it had its origins in the mid-century from a professor, and I can't remember now exactly where, who wrote a book. Might have been a professor at MIT. I have it in my notes somewhere. But it had its origins in the mid-century. But it really came to fruition in the early to mid-80s when Steve Jobs at Apple kind of took ownership of it and ran with it within the Apple Corporation. And what he did was he valued design thinking himself. And as you know, or as most people know, Apple products are highly valued because of their attention to detail in terms of design. So we have to shift our mind a little bit and think about the origins of design thinking, or the way in which Steve Jobs was approaching design thinking was from a product-based standpoint. So he was, and Apple still is, and many other Fortune 500 companies, because of Steve Jobs, have come to really value design thinking. So nowadays, it's being applied across a myriad amount of professions and fields. Those that have to do with designing an actual product that a consumer or someone would use, but also to us in the healthcare industry, and how we provide or develop a service, right? So it can be applied across a number of different ways of thinking, whether you're producing something or whether you're creating some sort of service, or you can just think of it as an outlook on how you live your life really as well. So Steve Jobs said, I value this, and said to a group of engineers, I want you to approach developing, and what they were working on was the computer mouse. This was early, and he said, I want you to really don't think that you know what I want or what people want. And that was really revolutionary. And Kate, I believe that's still revolutionary in our world of therapy.
Yes, yes.
If you can relate to this, I know I relate to it, and hopefully your listeners do as well, in that we have a tendency, and I think a lot of our college programs where we are educated have a tendency to teach us how to assess our clients. And are set up sort of from a paradigm of that we're the leader, we're the expert, we're going to go through this period of assessment, and then we're going to enter a period of treatment, and then we're going to enter a period of evaluation, and then we're going to end a period of termination of treatment or continuance of treatment. And it's all about us having to know and be responsible and think of ourselves as the leader and the developer and the designer. That puts a lot of pressure on us. And as a younger, greener therapist, I fell into that same trap that I've heard a lot of younger, greener therapists now tell me that they fell into. But I went all through school, and I've studied my methods classes, and I did my practicum and then my internship, and I should know. And if I fail, or if an intervention with a client doesn't work, then therapy isn't working. I'm not working.
It holds so much weight at that, when it's in that thought process. Those things, those failures, I hate to say failure because it's not, but they hold so much weight.
And it's all on us, right? And so Steve Jobs said, I'm kind of circling back to, I don't know what he really said, but I kind of do because I researched it a little bit. But basically, he came from the design thinking paradigm, which was don't think that you know, or that you have to know right now what the consumer wants. You go out there and see how they're using the product. Observe them, ask questions, brainstorm lots of ideas. There isn't one right way of thinking about it. There are a myriad numbers of ways. The consumer is the leader. And that translates for us into the client is the leader. So I enter every session now thinking that way. I don't think that can happen overnight. I think that it takes clinical growth and maturity and application, right? You have to keep reminding yourself, you know, you have to have that growth mindset. I'm going to get stuck, and that's okay. And my client is going to, the client is the leader of the experience. They're the user of the service. And so that is what Steve Jobs charged his initial engineering team that was developing the computer mouse to do, was to don't just come up with things that you fancy well-educated engineers think that the world needs. Instead, you go out and you start with the first stage, which is empathizing. And Kate, this comes naturally to any therapist, right? Empathize with your user, your consumer, your client. Empathize with them. Have an understanding of what they want music therapy or our service to provide for them. Have an understanding of their circumstances, their perception. We might have a completely different perception. Stage two of design thinking goes into defining. So first you have empathizing, then you have defining. Defining is a critical part because that's where you're saying, what's the problem? So you want to define what the issue is that you're trying to create, right? So if someone is in the product industry, what's the problem? When I was developing material for design thinking kind of 1.0 to sort of introduce this concept to clinicians, I took a little bit of the language that you hear a lot about in leadership training, which has to do with the wicked problem. So when you talk about defining the problem, you have to say to yourself, what's the right problem that I should be focusing on, right? So we as therapists think, we empathize with our client. That comes naturally. We're all taught to do that. And then we go into this assessment phase, which again, I think a lot of times we think, oh, I'm the expert. I'm the one who should be figuring out what my client should be working on. But design thinking flips that and says you want, it should be a conjoined experience, a dual experience, and that you should be making sure that you're focusing on the right problem. And this is where I think a lot of times we as therapists get stuck. This is just stage two of design thinking. But I think a lot of times we get stuck because we're not, our interventions, our clinical work perhaps isn't as successful initially as we want it to be, because we're not focusing on the right problem right then for our client. And so if we're focusing on the wrong problem, all of our interventions might not be working and we're going to feel stuck. But because I think a lot of times in our training, we're taught or we put upon us that we should be the leader, we should be the expert, we don't necessarily do what design thinking says to do, which is to keep brainstorming. So design thinking values, I mentioned before, the perception of the consumer, the perception of the user over the perception of the leader. And the other thing that is important to remember is that design thinking values early failure over early success. And the reason it does that is because it's through our failures, it's through those oops moments and those mistakes. Now, I don't mean that we're going to do something, you know, horrible to our client.
Purposefully, yeah.
We're going to still use ethics and our code of practice, you know, our standards of practice. But what I mean is that when we feel stuck in a session and we have that moment of this isn't working, we should be able, guilt-free, to do a 180 or a 90-degree turn and say to our client or our client's family, we're going to go in a different direction. Let's try something new. Come with me. Let's do this. Because it's really a journey that you're taking together with your client, right? So design thinking values perception of the consumer over us, and it values early failures over early successes, because it's in the failing and the trying and what design thinking calls ideating and prototyping, which are the next two phases. I'll review them in a minute. Ideating is like brainstorming. I'm coming up with ideas. So ideating means I'm ideaing. And then prototyping is I'm putting it into action. I'm experimenting. Let's just move on this intervention, this particular music exercise to work on X goal is not working. The first thing that design thinking would say to do is to go back to defining your problem. Is your goal not the right problem? Or is your goal not focusing on the right problem? I mentioned a minute ago that design thinking So we have empathizing, then we have defining. And so in design thinking, the defining is coming up with the right problem. And I mentioned, I took a little bit of language from the leadership training. And leadership training talks a lot about the wicked versus the tame problem. I don't know if you're familiar with that vernacular. Some of your listeners might be. But the tame problem is this, the thing that is easily fixed. I have strep throat. I need to get an antibiotic.
Very clear cut.
And you can do, it's very solution oriented.
Yes.
So I'm always late for work. I need better time management. And if I follow these three steps, I will start getting to places on time. So it's very clear cut. There's an easy solution. Wicked problems are, and I think I used this example in the conference presentation that you came to, we're living a wicked problem. COVID is our wicked problem.
Yep, it's a great example.
So a wicked problem are those problems that are tricky. They change often. The criteria for them evolve and change. And so we need to ideate. We need to come up with lots of different ways of thinking about them and lots of different ways of attacking them. And so that is the mindset for trying to develop goals for our client. What is the wicked problem? What is the sticky widget? And how can I attack that? If I say to myself, though, well, my sticky widget is autism. My client has autism spectrum disorder, and that's my area of expertise. I'm not going to get very far because I can't do anything about that, right? I can't do anything about the fact that my client has autism. But what I can do is say, well, what is the upstream problem that's affecting maybe this downstream goal area, right? So I specialize in social communication and social cognition. And so if I say to myself, well, my wicked problem is that my client has very impacted social cognition. And there are lots of elements of social cognition. That's huge. There are lots of different ways of attacking that. But what I first might have to say is, what in this particular client is impacting their ability to grow in social cognition? A lot of times for the older kids and teens with autism spectrum disorder that I work with, it's a dysregulated sensory system. So they have a dysregulated sensory motor system. Well, now I'm getting closer to a problem that I can really attack. But if I say, well, my client has autism, and so there's just these myriad of things I could be working on, right? Let's narrow it down. Let's come up with an area, like in my world, social cognition, social communication, where we can really work on some specific areas, noticing what's going on around you, right? In orientation to social partners, referencing other people, using comments, questions and answers, if you're working on conversation skills. But if those aren't happening well, if you feel stuck in your ability to work on those, that wicked problem area, the wicked problem area of social communication, lots of different ways you can attack it. It's a really big area. It's the core crux area for people with autism. Then you have to say to yourself, well, what's the upstream thing that is affecting the downstream functioning in that area? So a lot goes into defining. Sizing stage, then we have this defining stage. Then once we really hone in on, as clinicians, what we've defined as our problem, and we release some tension from ourselves in saying, there are lots of ways we could work on this. We could share a client, Kate, and you could come up with 10 different ways to work on social cognition for a 15-year-old client that I have. And I could come up with 10 other ways, and they'll all be valuable. Not all work, but the ones that don't work get us closer to ones that will work. So we then ideate. We come up with all these ideas. We brainstorm, and design thinking values continuous brainstorming and continuous experimentation. So the first three stages are empathizing, defining, then ideating, idea making, and then prototyping. Prototyping is basically the experiment phase. How am I then coming up with interventions, right? What are my exercises? What are the, and that's where I think we as green therapists, we jump there.
Yes, yes.
Content dump in college, and then we jump into, I have to create these exercises. and they need to work.
Yes.
Work, then I'm not a good therapist. And design thinking turns all that on its head and says, no.
And I think we go back as green therapists, you'd get the content dump and it's about the prototyping and intervention. And even maybe a little bit the step before of like thinking of ideas, but we don't go back to maybe it's not the problem. We don't go back one more step at all. It's always just like, let's just stay in this loop of those last two stages.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we have to continually. So another thing that's important to remember that I haven't mentioned yet is that we're talking about these different stages, but I don't want to give the impression that they are a linear framework. They're not a hierarchy, they're cyclical. So when I talk about it in a conference presentation with PowerPoint slides, I show it in a cyclical form that kind of help give people that visual so that you're exactly right. So if you're stuck in a session and you think about it later, you start ideating about it later, that might be where you say to yourself, okay, I'm thinking about X problem. Maybe I need to go back a stage, or not back, but jump back to redefining. And we're going to continually be redefining. Because if our therapy is working, if our interventions with clients are successful, then we're going to need to move on. Other things are going to be coming into play, and a good clinician will be able to jump on that and say, you know, I have several clients with autism who, you know, I know, the family knows. I'm a big believer in telling and talking through with my clients before we start an exercise, what the exercise is working on and how they contribute to the work, because it's, the music is driving the work, but it's their work. I'm a coach. I see myself as a social coach, particularly when I'm working on social, I say social coach, I'm working on social skills a lot of times. And so if something is working, we want to have that back and forth with our client to be able to then, if something different comes up, let's put this goal or this method or way of working on hold for a little bit and go in a different direction. That's okay. And design thinking really values that. And so then after your prototyping, the last phase is testing. And so in a product, if you were thinking about it, again, with the Steve Jobs analogy, if you're thinking about it from an engineering product-driven framework, then you would say that's where you're testing out your computer mouse. Prototypes, they all work a little bit differently, right? Or you've created all these interventions with your client. They all have different elements to them. And music is working in different ways, temporally, melodically, volume-wise, the pace. I mean, you think I'm speaking now to, you know, elements of music, but you have all these different interventions. And then the testing phase for us might be more of the, that's where we're going back with our client and making sure with our client and our client's family, what are they doing? Is the work that we're doing in our therapy session transferring out of the therapy session? And if not, why? And how are we as clinicians giving homework every week so that there's work happening outside of the therapy session? I'm a big believer in homework because we have to have transferability, right? Now, I realize there are a lot of therapists who work in more acute care types of situations where they're not with clients for a long period of time. So their experience is going to be different. But I think the similarity is that they're still looking at, well, what is my time with this client from the beginning to the end, right? It's really, it's just a different time frame, but you can still follow through the steps, but at a faster pace. So that testing phase might be then where we do the work of, how is this going? What kind of homework can I be giving you to make this really tangible and transferable between therapy sessions? And then that's going to help bring us back, shoot us back to defining. What else are we working on? What else are we defining? How else can I empathize with my client? So that we're really going through all these these phases. One other thing I wanted to share before I forget. I think that one of the things that I thought about, and I hope that you can relate with and your listeners can relate with, is I think we do a lot of internal dialoguing about us as the leader, right? Instead of thinking of the client as the leader. I think I told you I've sort of shifted that. So I think of the client as the leader of the experience and I'm the coach. But I think when I was a greener therapist, I would have this internal dialogue of what should I do? What should I do? And whether it was an intervention wasn't working or I was session planning for the next session. And instead, design thinking would say, and what I challenge you and other clinicians to say instead is, what can I try? What can I try? What should I try that I haven't tried? That's such a friendlier, more open way of thinking of ourselves as skilled, competent, caring professionals, which we know we are. What can I try? Let's try something. Not what should I be doing? That puts so much pressure on us.
It really does.
And yeah. So there are all these companies out there that use design thinking, Google and Apple, and they're throwing big money at their employees to intentionally fail. Right? They're saying to them, it's okay. Keep going. Keep trying. Redefine. Keep ideating. Prototyping. Your growth of your mindset, your growth of what you create will, they think, continually benefit their consumer or their user. I don't think that the therapy field do that, right? I think we could be doing more of it. So this, you know, I've been talking long enough, but that sort of encapsulates a lot of what I've learned. And it all started with that podcast, you know, where I had that aha moment of, I think I've been doing this, but I haven't. I think that we'll all, if your listeners do a deeper dive into design thinking and those five stages, I think they'll find out that they have strengths in one or two of those areas. And there are other areas that they'll say, oh, I don't do as much of that. And so maybe it'll spawn them to try, right? What can I try? For me, my area of strength was prototyping. I have a musical theater background. And so I think that emphasis on acting and improv and just performing in the moment, right, from theater classes and things, has maybe, I don't know, I'm guessing, but developed my strength of let's just shift gears. Let's shift gears. I'm going to try something. What I wasn't great at in the beginning, and which I've worked hard to develop, is the testing with my clients, right? Going back and developing that dialogue of here's what we're working on. Here's why I think it's important. What do you think? What are you working on? What are you seeing in the times that we're not in a session? And what was the other area I was, defining, you know, just redefining, making sure that I'm attacking the right wicked problem. Yeah. And not beating myself against a brick wall. Yeah.
Yeah. I think sometimes it's so easy to get like you nailed down with the defining the problem that then going back to it, you know, remembering to go back to, wait, is this really the problem? Because then you could be spending who knows how long on the thing that won't get you anywhere or help, really truly help.
Right. And I think that's where your client is going to help you too, right? Because they may be saying, well, we really want to work on, and I've had this happen to me, I don't know how many times. And it's not easy to have these conversations, I think, in the beginning when you're maybe, it depends on your personality and the stage that you are in your career. that I know I've had client families tell me, you know, well, we really just want, you know, to have, we've really just got to have our client work on his communication skills. You know, we just, you know, he's only giving like one word answers. We really want to build his vocabulary, his communication. And then we as clinicians might need to do the work of, well, helping them understand through observing the client, right? Pointing out through observation, because design thinking really values that. That's part of the empathizing and defining area. When you're empathizing, when you're defining, you want to be observing your client. And so we might have to have those uncomfortable but necessary conversations to say, I'm noticing this about little Johnny. I'm noticing this. And we use a lot of I statements about what we're observing to help our clients' families understand that communication is a great goal, but we have some upstream areas we need to work on in order to attack communication. And those might be primarily probably attention networks, right? We have to have social and joint attention so that communication is happening authentically and meaningfully. We have to have a regulated sensory motor system so that we can actually use different forms of attention functionally. And so a lot of times we might be having to have those conversations with our clients if we feel that there's a disconnect between what we as clinicians are observing and want to work on versus what they might first seek us out for. You know, like, oh, I want music therapy to really work on Johnny's communication skills. That's great. Very valuable point. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the foundational basement level skills that need to be in place so that we can work on communication, so that we can work on executive function. Hopefully that makes sense.
Totally. Yeah, especially because it's easy. I think it can be easy to look at a problem and just say, it's this big problem. I feel like that happens with behavior a lot of, you know, oh, well, they just need to stop getting this feeling or that feeling. And then that explaining of like, well, there's, you know, we've got to go way up back upstream. There's so many more things before that that's going to play into this bigger thing. It's, you know, we got to start, which is, I think, hard for some families to hear of like, it's not a quick fix. It's not, you know, like we will get there, but we have to start way back here to go all the way down.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it depends on, you know, everyone's journey with their particular problem, disability, different way of functioning, however you want to phrase it, is going to be different, right? And so part of our job as clinicians is, you know, we're not creating a product that's going to be used by millions of people in basically the same way, like a computer mouse, right? So a lot of design thinking for us is going the way that we move through those phases for our particular growth as clinicians and for particular relationships with clients is going to look really different, right? Because it's defined by each individual experience. How I move through or think about design thinking affecting my therapy with one client might be really different than with another. Versus when you think about design thinking for a product, you know, it's usually a lot more global. I would imagine, I'm not an engineer, but, you know, those engineer types are thinking about developing something that's going to be used by everyone, right? Or by this huge mass group of the population. Whereas it's trickier for us, I think, because we have to take into account all the nuances of those types of relationships. Like you said, you know, it might be hard for families to hear, it might be difficult for clients to understand. But I think we become better clinicians for having those conversations. I think it helps us really pinpoint down what we're working on in any given time. I think it also helps us work on one thing at a time. I know when I was a younger therapist, I was working on too many things. You know, that was one of my my early, you know, fail moments, was that I was trying to work on too much with a client in one session or over the course of multiple sessions. And sometimes we just have to, again, you know, step back, think about what's possible on maybe a smaller scale, not beat ourselves up if something isn't working, but to just remind ourselves that we can keep trying. What can I try? What can I try? And I think that trying is what I spoke earlier about. I think design thinking, I didn't know what design thinking was, but I think that rapid prototyping, which is what it's called in design thinking, rapid prototyping, just generating lots of experimenting, lots of interventions. I'm pretty quick as a songwriter. That's a strength of mine. So coming up with new songs and new material, not always presenting things in the same way, that was a strength for me. And so that helped me not burn out. But then there are going to be other areas, like I mentioned before, that not all these areas might come naturally to us. We have to kind of think about, that's where we can grow as a clinician, right? We can apply it to our work with our clients, but then we can also say, okay, which of these five areas do I feel are really strong in my own wheelhouse? And which are the ones that I need to maybe focus on a little bit more?
I had a similar aha moment hearing you talk about it at conference, because it's such a different way. It's almost a strategic humanistic approach to coming up with, you know, even step-by-step processes for implementing interventions, because it's so, I love how much the individual is in control. The client has that, you know, they're not so much control, but I guess their perception is the value of, you know, what's their buy-in? What do they want to do? And how can we honor who they are 100% while, you know, coming up with the ideas and trying to help on the sidelines of, you know, being on the side like that?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I work with a very complex middle schooler. He has autism. He has cortical vision impairment. He has a seizure disorder. He usually needs two caregivers at any one time to sort of help him navigate through the world. He's very active. He has a very hyper sensory motor system that needs to maintain equilibrium in order to really show what he can do cognitively and motorically. And your speaking to this point reminds me of years ago, when I think I was at one of his IEP meetings, or I was in like a behavior team meeting with some of his behavior therapists. And this was before I knew anything about design thinking. But I understand his neurology, his neuro profile very well, because I've worked with him since he was an infant and at Anchor Center for Blind Children. And now, like I said, he's now a middle schooler. So he likes really strong, heavy proprioceptive input. So he likes to take things and scratch them against the wall and drop them on a wooden floor to hear the echo and feel the vibration. And that is a strength of his. He's strong. He knows how to get an object, almost any object, and use it to feed and fuel his own sensory motor system. But he when we as his care team were talking about him and the profile of his learning, I said something along the lines of, we're not going to get rid of that. I didn't see as a clinician the value in taking those experiences away from him. They're part of who he is. They are, you know, to your point about, like, you know, thinking about things from a very humanistic or client-centered approach. And I wouldn't have described my training as humanistic. It was much more behavioral focused. But my point with his team was that we needed to broaden his repertoire. We need to broaden his cognitive abilities so that we can add to his repertoire of satisfying play experiences, of experiences that are socially driven, so that he's doing more things with other people instead of just being object-centered, where he needs to get something so that he can feed his own sensory neural system, system. And so I still think about him that way, you know, and when new behavior therapists come into his team and they come and observe in sessions in music therapy with him, because music therapy is a strength for him and a preferred environment for him, I will use that as an example, you know, that this is something that he does and gets a lot of pleasure from. But we have to allow, we can put time restraint. Obviously, we don't want him just walking around throwing things and scraping everything against the wall. But it's more of a paradigm. It's more of a change in perspective. That's part of his makeup. It's always going to fuel him. He's always going to seek that type of experience out. But what else can we be providing him? Instead of trying to tap that down, let's just put that over here, know that it exists, and build around it, build other play experiences around it that are equally, or hopefully will become equally as meaningful to him. And I think that's design thinking, right? So I think, you know, design thinking can kind of spawn up in a lot of different ways. You know, another way that it spawned for me was I have this group of young adults who I worked with all individually. There's four of them. And I was working on a lot of perspective taking and higher order social communication things with them. Two of them have Down syndrome and two have Asperger's syndrome. And I think it was about 4 years ago now, and this group is still meeting. We're now meeting during COVID-19 online every Friday. But I kind of design funk a masterclass for them. So I wanted to be able to have them in a group, but they didn't really necessarily want, nor did I think they would buy into a more traditional music making group. Like, you know, we're going to do a songwriting group, or we're going to do, some of them do songwriting in their individual work, but we're going to do a drumming group, or we're going to do, I knew that wasn't the way to go. And so somehow I came up with this idea of masterclass. You know how when we're music students and we, you know, we have studio time, right? Where we perform for those other musicians in our studio, or we do a masterclass with, you know, a musician or a professor that we're mentoring with, and we have to come into that class with something prepared that we present to the group. And so every week the masterclass meets, and every week we have a theme, a topic. Last week it was Mother's Day was our topic. So everyone had to research a song that had to do with, it could have been a personal experience of theirs, like a song their mom sang to them when they were little, or it could have been a song that was more overtly about mother and child relationship or something. and they present it. So each one of them gets up in front of the rest of the group, and they have to give three or four research facts about the song, the composer, the song, what it's about, background information. And then we either listen to the song or we watch the video. And then the leader gets back up in front of the class, in front of the group, and has two questions that they pose to the group about the topic of their song. And the goals of the group are all around higher order social communication skills and theory of mind. Theory of mind is basically perspective taking, right? So we'll have a lot of conversations about why some people enjoyed a particular song and why some didn't. And how, you know, the music again is, you know, in that particular group, there's no active music making. They do that in their individual sessions. But the whole context of the group is around music and them having to explore their concept of self-confidence and leadership and verbal communication, fielding questions and answers, which is really hard for a lot of my young adults with Asperger's syndrome, perspective taking, all of those things that have to do with social cognition. And I think I created it from a space of design thinking, you know? I was defining, oh, this particular group could all come together. They don't all know each other, but they, you know, they share these kind of common areas in which they could be working. And this feels like the right problem for them to all be working on as a collective. And it's been a really successful group. It started out as a group of three. Now it's a group of four. Yeah, it's really fun.
And the, like, applying that, you know, there, I think there's so much more. There's so much that can come from the group experience when you're applying design thinking to then a group. It's like, woo, so many things.
Yeah, it's kind of mind-boggling, right? Think about all the ways music can be applied as an intervention, right? Why we never run out of material.
There's always some.
There's always something else you can do.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I love both of those examples are so amazing. I'm really excited that we got to hear individual and group, kind of those, you know, those different pieces from, and
intentionally, but
that's what I love about just talking in our podcast, because we just end up going down these awesome places and just stuff comes up and, yeah, it's always so, I love that group. That sounds like so much fun, a masterclass with.
Fun, and that's what we call it. We call it masterclass.
Yes, yeah.
They've all really grown individually. Yeah. They've also come to understand one another's communication styles, right? Because they're all really different, you know? And so we're improving areas in which they all communicate, but they all still have their unique personalities that they're always going to have, right?
Yes.
Their sets of strengths and challenges. It's a really fun group. And like I said, it started with three and now it's a group of four, which I think is a really nice size. I usually limit my groups to five if I can. My social skill area groups, because it just makes for a more authentic
and intimate, where you can really get all of that information that you need when with everybody, and too many dynamics and it's hard to, I think, keep a focus,
right? And then it's just and then you're just kind of managing instead of
been in those groups.
You're managing instead of coaching, which is
yes. Well, as we start to wrap up, there's going to be lots of links in the show notes to design thinking, the podcast, a bunch of the different stuff we'll have links to for listeners who want to learn more. But if listeners are interested in contacting you, if they want to talk to you more so about this too, what would be a great place to get a hold of you?
So just my email address. So awesome. It's Bryant@comcast.net. I'm happy to provide you with the slides.
Oh, yeah, that'll be perfect. I will put that in. I send a newsletter out every month, so I'll make sure that those are into the newsletter. So if anyone's listening, I'll put my newsletter link in there too. So then that'll be in a nice PDF. That'll be great. Thank you.
Love to hear from people who, you know, you might have some other clinicians listening who know gobs more than I do, or have been applying some of these principles as well, or, you know, I like being in the student role as well. So, so I'm hearing feedback from people who, you know, if this is their thing and their wheelhouse and they have things that they could teach me, that would be great too. But I can give you some of the references. I didn't reference them today in our talk, but there is like a references page for Design Thinking 1.0 and Design Thinking 2.0. So if people want to look at some of the articles or things I've looked at, that's there. There's a ton out there. I mean, if you Google design thinking, you can do, I'm sure there's probably a couple TED Talks on it. I'm sure there's, you know, and everyone's perspective is going to be different depending on who they're using it with, right? I mean, I come at it from that clinical therapist-client relationship, or thinking about it from a clinical standpoint. I'm sure an engineer talking about it would sound really different.
Or building a website, I could 100% see.
Exactly. So,
yep.
So it's gonna, you know, design thinking will sound different depending on who it's designed for.
Yes, which is the great thing about it. It's so flexible.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking with everybody and just sharing your passion. This is such a cool topic that I think every clinician could benefit from hearing. So I hope listeners, you know, write in, share it, talk to more people, because it's just so, so awesome. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was really
fun. Yes. All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that episode. I am so excited to implement design thinking into my intervention planning, into just creative thinking in general for my therapy practice. But also I'm really excited to figure out how to bring it into other realms, because it's just so applicable to a variety of things of creative problem solving in general. Just a reminder that there is an anonymous survey that is located in our show notes, and that will be a permanent addition to our show notes and will always be there. This survey is for you to express any concerns, suggestions, feedback, anything that you want to send over to Creative Therapy Umbrella and let us know. That is a really easy way to open up any type of communication that you would like to send over to us. So I highly suggest that you utilize it. I really want to hear what you have to say. I'm really passionate about making this podcast as supportive, helpful, and useful to you as possible. And so your voice is incredibly important in making that happen. Thank you guys so much for listening, and be creative.